Deep in an isolated forest stands Château de Sillings, a fortress deliberately sealed from the outside world, where four powerful men have orchestrated a four-month retreat to explore the darkest corners of human nature. These libertines, representing aristocracy, clergy, law, and finance, have created a controlled environment where conventional morality is systematically inverted. Virtue faces punishment, while transgression receives reward. The Gothic architecture serves as a powerful metaphor for psychological descent, with subterranean levels symbolizing deeper stages of moral abandonment. This remote chateau becomes a laboratory where human nature, freed from societal constraints, reveals what these men believe to be its fundamental essence, the complex relationship between power, pleasure, and suffering. What makes this exploration truly disturbing isn't merely its content, but its meticulous organization. The libertines don't pursue random acts of cruelty, but establish an elaborate system, a constitution of libertinage that mirrors conventional social structures while perverting their purpose. This calculated approach suggests something far more unsettling than mere individual depravity: the potential for systematic corruption within the institutions we trust to protect us. Life at the chateau operates with military precision. Inhabitants follow rigid schedules of meals, storytelling sessions, and activities, all under constant surveillance. A rotating steward position begins with Dersette, who conducts inspections checking clothing, cleanliness, and compliance. Subjects must maintain specific postures, kneel before the libertines, and address them as "my lord." Most disturbing is how natural functions become tools for domination. Subjects can relieve themselves only at specified times with explicit permission, and only in the desecrated chapel converted into a privy where libertines observe them. This control over bodily needs represents ultimate domination, reducing victims to physical beings whose natural impulses become occasions for humiliation. The four libertines embody different aspects of corrupt power: the Duke, brute force; the Bishop, corrupted religion; President de Corval, perverted justice; and Dersette, distorted finance. Their wives represent virtues under assault: Constance, with innate virtue; Adelaide, with romantic sensibilities; Julie, showing mixed corruption and humanity; and Aline, preserving innocence while detesting the infamies she endures. The storytellers, Duclos, Champfil, Martin, and Desgraniers, function as historians of depravity, each specializing in increasingly severe perversions. 16 privileged adolescents, 8 males and 8 females, aged 12 to 15, exhibit diverse psychological responses to systematic manipulation. Some develop behaviors that reinforce their exploitation. Augustine adapts to please abusers. Zellmeyer seeks spiritual refuge, attracting more abuse. And Sophie's attachment to her deceased mother becomes weaponized against her. Most disturbing is how victims transform into participants. Julie, whose father holds authority, aligns with the power structure, demonstrating how institutional abuse converts victims into facilitators through psychological conditioning rather than physical force. The perpetrators deliberately disrupt authentic bonds between victims, as when they oppose Adelaide and Sophie's mutual support. This systematic prevention of connection reveals the libertines' understanding that victim solidarity threatens their control. These dynamics mirror abusive relationships, cults, and authoritarian regimes. Effective control relies not on physical force, but on psychological manipulation that turns victims against themselves and each other. Understanding these mechanisms helps us recognize and resist them. Beyond its shocking content, the work presents a philosophical system through the libertines' discussions. The Duke justifies matricide by claiming, "Nature often inspires what mortals call criminal impulses," suggesting conventional morality contradicts natural drives. Kerval adds, nothing's villainous if it causes an erection, and the single crime that exists is to refuse oneself anything that might produce a discharge. These dialogues reveal a radical materialism, reducing human experience to physical sensation while rejecting transcendent moral principles. Durset argues against charity, claiming inequality is natural and aiding the poor disrupts nature's intentions, a dark parody of Enlightenment rationalism. The libertines find greatest pleasure in blasphemy and religious desecration. Adelaide's religious devotion becomes her most punishable offense as it represents resistance to their materialist worldview. The libertines find greatest pleasure in blasphemy and religious desecration. This assault on conventional values challenges us to examine our moral foundations. If we reject the libertines' conclusions, what grounds our moral certainties when religious frameworks no longer command universal acceptance? The work progresses through increasingly extreme forms of perversion across four parts: Duclos' simple passions with mild sexual deviations, Champfil's complex passions featuring elaborate domination, Martain's criminal passions involving permanent bodily harm, and finally Descrange's murderous passions where sexuality and death merge. This structure illustrates transgression as inherently progressive. Conventional pleasures lead to satiety, driving libertines toward increasingly extreme acts. As Kerval states, satiety of common pleasures leads to abominations. Each transgression normalizes previous ones, creating an endless cycle of escalation that reveals something disturbing about desire itself. The progression culminates in theatrical torture scenarios combining sexual gratification with methodical cruelty, suggesting imagination's capacity for cruelty exceeds physical limitations. Throughout, the work maintains clinical detachment, cataloging perversions with scientific precision. This pattern mirrors our modern media landscape, where what shocked previous generations now seems tame, requiring increasingly extreme content to produce the same emotional response. This insight, that transgression creates its own momentum, remains a disturbing contribution to understanding human psychology. Despite its 18th-century origins, the work presents disturbing parallels to modern systems of oppression. The libertines' meticulous record-keeping, schedules, and categorization foreshadow the bureaucratization of atrocity in totalitarian regimes. The Duc's colored ribbon system for identifying children reflects the administrative logic that would later enable mass atrocities. The chateau's isolation creates a state of exception where conventional morality is suspended, similar to modern concentration camps and black sites. The requirement for victims to use only lascivious and blasphemous language mirrors how totalitarian systems control not just actions, but speech itself. Most disturbingly, the work reveals how oppressive systems develop internal logic that normalizes atrocity. Kerval's philosophy that nature often inspires what mortals call criminal impulses echoes modern ideological justifications for violence. In this exploration of power's corruption, we find not merely a catalog of perversions, but a prophetic vision of modernity's darkest potential, where meticulous organization combines with extreme cruelty, applying rational principles to irrational ends. The work confronts fundamental questions about human nature. The libertines' progression from conventional sexuality to torture suggests cruelty may be inherent in desire itself. When Kerval declares, "the more atrocious the crime, the greater the pleasure," he reveals the disturbing link between transgression and gratification. Victims' responses, from Adelaide's religious devotion to Julie's corruption, showcase the complex spectrum of human adaptation to abuse. Some maintain moral integrity despite torture, while others become accomplices in their degradation, complicating simple victimhood narratives. The work challenges belief in natural human goodness. Dorset's pleasure in witnessing suffering presents compassion not as innate, but constructed, and therefore easily dismantled. What disturbs most is the challenge to our self-conception. By forcing us to confront the potential for systematic cruelty within human desire, it creates a mirror reflecting not just individual perversion, but collective potential, an abyss in our understanding of ourselves. Perhaps only by acknowledging this capacity for cruelty can we commit to creating protective rather than exploitative systems.